Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the last lecture of Austrian Macroeconomics, which, fittingly enough, will cover the Austrian business cycle theory, which is sort of the culmination of Austrian macroeconomics. And then we'll compare it to the Keynesian approach to macroeconomic stabilization. Okay, so that word stabilization always means smoothing out the economy, preventing inflation, that is a rise in prices according to mainstream jargon, and also smoothing out or preventing or lessening recessions. So I've introduced here a diagram put up that I wanted to give you last week, but it inadvertently got lost. And this is the structure of production. Now, we talked about how natural growth occurs with shifts between capital goods and consumer goods. But now what I want to do is,
go the other way.
Okay.
But you have to hover over it.
Okay.
Yeah. And then
drag off like that.
Okay.
Oops. So we have a bit of a technical difficulty here, but it'll be
kind of freezing up.
Yeah. Well, we're having a little problem with the diagram, but let me just introduce it by telling you that actually it's not just capital goods and consumer goods. There's actually different stages of goods. This was introduced into Austrian economics with its founder, Karl Menger, who talked about higher and lower orders of goods or stages of goods. And so I'll explain when this is stabilized. I'll explain what we mean by stages of goods. But, and basically the higher stage, the stage of the higher number, is a good that's being produced further away from consumers. The lower stages progressively get closer and closer to consumers until you get to the first stage, which is the final or retail stage, where the consumer goods finishing touches are put on the consumer goods and then they're sold to consumers. So what we can do now is to look at how this works. Let's take a macroeconomy, a structure of production, and let's start with the first stage of production. This is the fourth stage or the highest stage. This is where production of the good begins. Okay, so it's a little bit counterintuitive to call it the fourth stage. Okay, but the highest stage is always the stage at which you're using land and labor to begin to make your first tools and capital goods. So what we have then in this stage is the following. Move over here. So there is $10 paid to wages. Okay, so you see this upward arrow. The capitalists that in this stage, the owners of the firms in this stage, pay $10 in total to wages. And we'll forget for a moment about natural resources. We'll assume that they're there, they're free, but they don't get any payment, to make it simple. So after, at the beginning of the stage, it takes 1 year, the wages are paid, the laborers then get together and are directed by the capitalists, entrepreneurs, the owners, to produce a product, a capital good. So let's say they're going to produce iron ore. So iron ore is produced, and then at the end of the year, the iron ore is going to be sold for $11, okay, to the next capitalist, the capitalist in the lower stage, the next lower stage. So this capitalist then buys the capital for 11. So notice that the investment by the fourth stage capitalist was $10. And they sold the product a year later for 11, which means that their interest return, you can see the interest return here in terms of dollars, is $1 or 10%. So in an evenly rotating economy, in an economy in which there's no change, everybody gets the same rate of return, the same that's called the natural rate of interest. Okay? And in a world where there is change, there's a continually a tendency for the rate of return to be uniform, which we'll see as we go through these stages. So in the third stage, capitalists pay out $11 for the capital good that has been produced in the fourth stage, but then they also have to have labor to work on that capital good. So they purchase $9 worth of labor. So wages are here, go up not to $9, and the $11 is paid here. So they've paid a total of $20. They've invested $20 in producing the capital good in the third stage. So then the labor works on the capital good that's already been produced, and another capital good that's closer to consumers is produced. Closer meaning it's more finished. It's a more finished product. So notice that they paid out 20. Okay, they paid out $9 of wages and $11 for the capital good from the fourth stage. And what they get then, at the end of the year, they get a capital good that they've got purchased from the laborers by paying them wages, and from the previous capitalist who made the fourth stage capital good by paying them what we call rent for the capital good. And so they sell it for $22. Now they've invested 9 in wages, as we said, and 11 in capital goods, and that's a total of $20. They then sell it at the end of the year at $22, and notice then that means, if I can move this for you, that means a return, an interest return of $2 on a $20 investment. So that's, again, 10% per year. And so we continue, and I'll just continue with this, and then we'll sum it up. So then that capital good, the third stage, as I said, is sold for $22 to capitalists in the second stage. Okay, now maybe that might have been steel. So this is now, steel is going into the stage in which it's fashioned into automobiles, to make it simple. So the people in this stage, the capitalists, pay $22 for the steel, let's say. Then they pay $28 for laborers who are going to work on, fashion the steel, and make it into the parts that are needed for the automobiles. So notice that they've invested $50. Okay, so they've paid $28 in wages, they paid $22 for the steel, and that's $50. At the end of the year, okay, with the laborers working on the steel, they have all the parts necessary to produce a car. Those are called capital goods also. That is sold for $55. So they've earned $5 in interest on a $50 investment. Okay, so they've earned 10% also. All right, so finally they sell it for $55. They sell it at the end of the year. And the capitalists in the first stage, let's say that's actually the auto companies themselves, the ones that assemble the automobiles, assemble all the parts into an automobile using the assembly line. So they pay $55 for the parts, and then they have to have assembly line labor. They pay wages of $45. That's a total investment of $100 in producing the automobiles. Or you can think of this, as I'll later talk about, it could also be bread, and we could have gone through different stages of bread production. So at the end, then they invested $100. After a year, the automobiles are completed, and they sell them to consumers for $110. Once again, they earn an interest return of $10. That's their natural interest return. Okay? And they've invested $100. And you can see it here. $45 they paid on wages. And we're assuming for simplicity, they pay the wages right at the beginning of the year. So the laborers have a 1-year contract. Actually, they pay them every few weeks or every month, but it makes it simpler to calculate the interest rate if you do it that way. So in any case, they also have paid $55. Okay, plus the $45 in wages, $55 in rents for the capital goods that they purchased. And at the end, they sell for $110, they've earned 10%. Okay, so let's sum all of this up. And so what we got here is, if we go down to consumption, the total consumption spending is $110. The total saving and investment, okay, which is all the investment in the wages and the capital goods in the successive stages, that comes out to be $180. So the total spending in this economy is $110 plus $180, which gives us $290. Okay? So the spending on consumption goods and then the spending on investment, including investment in wages paid to labor. So what is the consumption saving ratio, which reflects the time preference? It's 110, which is the total amount of consumption, spent on consumption, divided by 180, which is the total amount of saved and invested. So that's a ratio of 0.61. Okay. The natural rate of interest, as I've shown, is 10%. Okay, one ounce, $1 over $10, $2 over $20, and so on for each stage. Okay, otherwise, if those rates were not the same, then entrepreneurs and laborers would move to different stages of production until they were equalized. We then have wages. Now you can see all the wages totaled up here for all the stages. Wages paid are $92, and the interest accumulated, okay, is 18. Now what's going to be interesting, what you're going to see, what's going to be very meaningful, is that if you add the $92 to the $18, that gives you $110, which is exactly the amount spent by consumers. So you have the rents to capital goods are $88, the receipts from consumer goods are $110. The net income, okay, this is what we call net income. This is the net income that are paid to laborers for wages and to the capitalist entrepreneurs who have invested in the form of interest. So that's what we're interested in, the net income. Okay, that equals, here you can see it, okay, that equals consumption. Now why is that so? Okay, why, it will always be equal. The reason why it's equal is because even though the capital goods that are produced earn what we call a gross income, okay, there's a gross income paid to the capital goods, they earn rents. Those rents, okay, if you take any capital good, the capital good, the value of that capital good goes back to the capital good in the previous stage plus the wages paid for labor. The capital good itself earns nothing, okay? There's only a $5 return for time preference in investing in that capital good. So if you trace this all the way back to the fourth stage, you'll see that the capital good that's produced in that stage, there's no return for that capital good, okay? $11 is paid, $1 goes in interest to the capitalist entrepreneurs who produced it. The other $10 goes to the laborers. So all the money paid for capital goods all along the line are resolved into either wages or interest payments. That's the net income. Okay? The payment for any capital good at any stage always depends on the investment in that stage. So if you pay $55, as I said before, $50 was paid in wages and for the previous capital good. And $5 went to the capitalist entrepreneur for time preference. Not for the capital good, but for time preference. It was a natural interest return. So we find out here, for the Austrian, capital goods are just intermediate goods. They're just weigh stations on the path to producing the final consumer goods. Okay. So the net income in the economy is the total amount paid for consumer goods. It goes, as I said, to wages and to interest. Okay. The capital goods themselves do not receive any net return because whatever is paid for the capital good, whatever revenue is received when you sell the capital good, has always been previously invested in wages and in previous capital good, or if you go all the way back to the highest stage, simply in wages. So now let's see what happens when people's time preferences fall and they want to consume fewer goods now and they want to save and invest their money. So we'll go to the next slide here. And here what has happened is consumers have reduced their expenses or their expenditures to $90. They've taken $20 out of consumer spending from the year before, and they're now only spending $90. They've saved the additional $20. Okay, so now let's see what happens in this case. It's true that capital goods do fall, or rather consumer goods, total spending consumer goods fall. Now, does that mean that the Keynesians would claim that there is no that's going to discourage investment? In fact, it doesn't mean that at all, because the interest rate falls. Okay, these this extra or net investment is the extra investment beyond the year before, the net investment is invested in higher and higher stages. So what you're going to see is that there's more saving in this economy and less consumption. Now, I don't have to go through the stages at all, except to tell you that in this economy, because there's more investment and because the natural rate of interest has fallen, people receive, owners receive a lower interest return, okay? So let me just take one stage at random. Let's take the fourth stage here. This person invests $16 in buying the capital good from the previous stage, and then, let's see, $7 in wages, and gets a return of 1, okay? And that, as it's going to turn out, is about 7%. So everyone along the line here gets a return of about 7%, okay? So $4 in interest in this stage, you divide that by $60 invested in capital goods, an additional 20 invested in laborers. So what you get then is $80 of total investment, and that's divided into 4. And so if I go down further here, I'm having a little technical problem with the slide again. Push it up a little bit. It should come up in a moment. It's freezing up a bit, so we'll take care of that. So as you can see there, on the lower, below the consumer's expenditures, which is 90, okay, what you get is consumption of 90, obviously, and saving investment now has risen from 180 to 200. The total spending in the economy is still 290, which it was in the prior example, okay? But now more, relatively more, is spent on investment goods, okay, and that's 200 versus 180, than on consumer goods. That has gone down. And so the natural rate of interest is about, it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit off, but it's about, if you sort of round off, it's about 7%, okay? And that shows you in each stage the interest return divided by the investment in that stage. And it comes out to about 7%. So now, if you recall from the previous slide, we had a consumption-saving ratio, you can see the C/S there, equal to 0.61, because it was 110 divided by 180. Now, if you'll know, it's 90 divided by 200. And so we get, and there it's coming up now, we get 0.45. So the consumption-saving ratio has fallen, indicating lower time profits. And that has taken the interest rate down from 10% to around 7%. And notice also something else here, that the wages, if you look below the consumption-saving ratio, is only $75. So net income is 4. Interest is only $14. So net income, total net income now, if you go down here to net income, you see that it's wages plus interest, it's now 90, and it's equal to consumption. Before, wages plus interest was 110. And it's equal to consumption for the same reason. That is that all these different stages of capital goods are not independently productive. Okay, basically the return is to the laborers and the interest return to the capitalists. In the real world, we have to add in the landowners, the natural resource owners. They would get a net return. Okay, but again, to stress the Austrian point, which is very important, capital goods are not independently productive. They're simply time, labor, and land combined. Okay, combined over time. And they are transformed from the basic natural resources and labor through time into the final consumer's good, which is here. Okay, in that stage, you get the final consumer's good. Okay, now why does that matter? Well, it matters for living standards. Okay, so if I go to the next slide, we can compare living standards here. So notice we'll compare the two structures of production. So the number of stages in the first one is 4. This is the one where there was less saving and investment, more consumption. And in the second one, it was 6. So we have it's called a lengthening of the structure of production. Okay, this is what Austrians refer to when we have more capital. So it's a lengthening. But consumption, in terms of spending, has gone down from 110 to 90, but saving investment has gone up from 180 to 200. So we have the same total spending. It's 290 in both economies, but it's split differently among the stages of production. And the consumption-saving ratio, I've already compared them, it's lower in the economy where you have more saving and less consumption. Okay, it's 0.45 as opposed to 0.61. And then the natural rate of interest falls, and wages, now money wages are going to fall. I'm going to show you what happens to real wages. Money wages fall from $92 to $75 or $76, and the interest payments in terms of money falls from $18 to $14. Now, what does this mean? Does this mean that everybody's worse off? Both the capitalists and the laborers are worse off because their money incomes are lower? As a result of the reduction in consumption and increase in investment? Well, far from it. Because when you have additional stages of production, when you have a lengthening of the structure of production, it means you can produce more capital goods, and with the same amount of workers working with more capital goods, that lengthened structure of production, they become more productive. They can produce more things. And that's exactly what happens. Now, I'm going to change from my example of of automobiles to bread. So there's a slight mathematical error here, but I'll get to that. So what happens is the net income has fallen, and less is spent on consumption. But notice what has happened to price. I'll explain what. The price of consumer good, let's say it's bread, has gone down from $2 to 90 cents. Okay, so it's gone from $2 to 90 cents. Price has been cut in half. Why is that? Or more than cut in half? Because the real output of bread has increased. Now there's more and better ovens. Let's say there's computer-run ovens so that makes labor much more productive. They can produce much more bread per unit of time. Same amount of laborers in this economy. And I use 10 laborers as the example of the number of laborers. But notice that what has happened. The increased productivity has increased bread, has doubled the amount of bread produced by the same amount of laborers, okay, because now they're better and more productive capital goods that they use. So it's gone from 55 pounds of bread to 110 pounds of bread. Right? And now, so you had before total spending on consumption goods of $2 times 55 pounds, and you find that that's $110 spending on consumer goods. Here, this should be 90 cents, this should only be 100 pounds of bread. Because 90, this is where the arithmetical error comes, you can fix it. 90 times 100 pounds of bread, that's the increase, gives us $90 in spending. Okay, 90.9 times 100 is $90. So even though people are only spending $90 on consumption, rather than 110, they're getting much more goods, or many more goods, for that because the price has fallen. So if you look at the nominal wage, assuming assuming there's 10 workers, 10 laborers in this economy, make it simple. So you have 10 laborers, so you figure that the $92 total wages that were spent divided by the 10 laborers, so they're getting $9.20 each. Whereas here we have $75.72 that went for wages divided by the 10 laborers, you have wages of $7.57, which is less in nominal terms. But now let's look in real terms. The way you get the real wage is to divide the wage rate, which is here, okay, by the price of bread. So if you take the $9.20 that each worker was earning over the course of the year, or however many years you want to specify, divided by $2 for the bread, it turns out that they were earning per year 4.6 loaves of bread. Here, however, even though they're only earning $7.57 in nominal terms, in money terms, if you divide that by the much lower price of bread, 90 cents, you find out that each worker is consuming 8.41 pounds of bread per year. That's their real wage. So it's almost double. And then you can do the same thing with the real interest rate. Even though the interest payment is less to the entrepreneurs, they're actually making a higher real interest. Okay. But the key is that it's the increased productivity that offsets the fall in the money wage, that offsets the fall in the money interest payment. Okay. So you get more productivity even though your net income is lower. Okay. The increased amount of output brings you a greater real income. And that's what we're interested in. So in a capitalist economy that was growing, if the money supply never increased, and if we had no changes in the demand for money, though there probably would be, rather, let's say the money supply stays the same, and there will be an increase in the demand for money, actually, because people want to sell more bread, so they're selling more bread for the same amount of, they're selling more bread for the same amount of money in the economy. You'll find then that the demand for money is increased because of the increase in the amount of output that is trying to be sold on the market, and that will drive the price down. So what you would tend to get in a market is a fall in the price of the goods and services. Okay. So let's go on here. Okay, we don't need that. Okay, so we went through this natural economic growth in which I showed how the how labor shifted from consumer goods industries to capital goods industries when you got more saving and investment. Well, I've just shown you the same thing using a more complicated structure of production. Okay. And but let me just the lessons that we learned here, which are a little bit lower down here, are these the increase in saving and the temporary fall in production in consumption does not cause the economy to fall into recession. As we saw in the example I just gave you, far from falling into a recession, we had more capital goods built, and eventually, not right away, but eventually you'd have, when those capital goods are in place, much more productivity and more consumer goods. So standards of living rise. It also means shifting labor from producing iPods, jeans, and so on, to producing capital goods. And I showed you that in structured production. We have more stages of production. More labor was used in the higher stages than in the consumer goods stage. Okay? Why? Because you needed fewer laborers in consumer goods stages, because now you have all these capital goods that are coming out of the production process, and they're using that to produce the bread. The better ovens that are run by, that are controlled by computers and so on. And then finally, the increase in saving allows more investment that lengthens the structure of production and increases the amount of capital and labor productivity. I showed you that in the structure of production diagrams. Okay, so everyone's standard of living is raised, the capitalists and the laborers. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, now, I started to explain this slide last week. And so let me just start with it again, because this is where we get into the Austrian business cycle theory and how this process of economic growth goes awry when the government interferes and manipulates the interest rate rather than allowing the natural interest rate to fall when we have more increased voluntary savings and net investment. So, as we said last week, there's a number of things that a good business cycle theory must explain. The Austrian business cycle theory does explain all of these things. The Keynesians only explain really one. So the Austrians explain why inflation is always followed by recession or depression, and why the business cycle repeats itself. Okay, so that is why there are ups in the economy, why profits, output, wages, all rising together for a while, and prices also, and then inevitably that's followed by a crash, a fall in price, a fall in wages, a decline in the amount of output, and a fall in profits, okay, and all other indicators fall. Okay. So the Austrian business cycle theory, as I'll show you, does explain this. Now the second thing that explains why the business cycle has a much greater effect on capital goods industries than on consumer goods industries. Again, we'll see that the Austrian theory explains this. Now, the Keynesian theory can explain this because they claim, following Keynes, that investment spending is much more volatile that is, it fluctuates much more than consumer spending because of the animal spirits of the investors. Animal spirits sort of describe a horse that is very skittish. Sometimes a horse is very playful and happy and so on, and will do what you tell it. And other times the horse will just be spooked by something, will be scared, and it will take off. Okay, so that's like, of course, it came like investors. Sometimes they'll invest, they'll be confident in the future, they'll be optimistic. And other times those animal spirits will disappear, they'll be very pessimistic, and they will, they'll pull back on their investments. He doesn't explain why, though there's a recent book on irrational exuberance by one of the authors is Schiller, and I can't remember the other author off the top of my head, but they try to back up Keynes's idea of animal spirits as driving business cycles, okay, with their research in behavioral economics. So number two is explained by both the Keynesian and the Austrian theory, but three isn't, because macroeconomics is just that, it's macroeconomics. It doesn't focus on individual decision-making, especially not entrepreneurial decision-making. But we have to ask as Austrians, why is it that all of a sudden, after entrepreneurs have been extremely successful, most of them, and you can think of the run-up to the financial crisis, when almost everyone was successful, all businesses were booming, why suddenly they all become stupid and make mistakes? Okay. Or become overly greedy. Why do they suddenly become too greedy and make mistakes? Well, the Austrians can explain that. It's actually not the entrepreneurs themselves. They've been misled. Finally, why do oil prices tend to fall during a business cycle? That doesn't happen as much now since World War II. The rate of growth of prices slows down. That is, the rate of inflation slows down. But prices don't actually fall haven't fell since World War II. They did a little bit in Japan, 1998-1999. Japan did not have a deflation for all of the 90s. It was only for about two or three quarters in the late 90s that there was actually deflation in Japan. All that was happening was that the Japanese rate of inflation fell tremendously. Okay, so instead of prices going up by 6 or 7%, they were going up by 1 or 2%. That's still inflation. And to call that deflation is completely misconceived. What was going on there? What was going on there was the fact that the economy was stagnating because the Japanese government didn't allow adjustments in industry and in banking. Okay, in fact, there were many zombie firms in Japan that really were also producing nothing, but the workers were coming to work, sitting there, and they were getting paid. And the Japanese government was putting pressure on Japanese banks to loan to these zombie companies so that the unemployment that we saw, the visible unemployment, didn't go up. Okay, so this sort of structural rigidity that was introduced into the Japanese economy by the industrial policies of the Japanese government is what caused this long stagflation that we had in Japan, or rather long stagnation that occurred in Japan during the 90s and even into the last decade. And it still hasn't completely recovered. It has not gone back to its rate of growth during the 80s, some of which was artificial, was induced by the Japanese Central Bank and by government policies. Okay, so here we have inflation and artificial growth. And so this diagram is like the diagram I showed you for natural economic growth, but there's some differences which we'll go through. Okay, so let's say now the Fed comes into the picture right here. And there's no change in consumption spending. People do not cut back initially on consumption. There's no change in consumption. People are going along, spending their income according to their time preferences, which have not changed. They're not spending any less on consumption and they're not saving anymore. But now the Fed comes in, increases the bank reserves, okay, so upward arrow for increase and R for reserves. As the bank begins to loan these increased reserves out, the interest rate falls because to get businesses and consumers to borrow more, you have to give them a reason. You have to lower the rate. at the current interest rate, they're borrowing all that they want. Supply equals the demand. But in order to get them to borrow the excess funds now that have been created by the Fed, you have to lower the interest rate. So the interest rate fall, that does cause lending to increase as more businesses will borrow at lower rates. That will also cause the money supply to increase. The arrow, I put it afterwards. Actually, there should be an arrow here. And it also causes an increase in investment, okay? Because people don't take money, especially businesses, don't borrow money just to let it lie around, okay? Or the word maybe lay around. They want to invest it, they want to get a return on it because they're paying interest on it. So you get an increase in investment. Okay, so now there's been no increase in saving, yet we suddenly have more investment out of these created, artificially created funds. So now let's follow these arrows. What happens is, again, even though so far there's no change in the consumer goods industries, you have an increase in demand for capital goods because you have this additional money that's been injected into the system and that is now being invested in building new factories, opening new mines, building more oil drilling equipment, and so on. So you have an increase in the demand for capital goods, A, subscript for capital goods. Their prices go up, profits in the capital goods industry increase, therefore they want to produce more capital goods to meet the increased demand for them. And therefore, this is when they begin to bid labor away. They raise wage rates. They bid for labor. But labor is fully employed, either producing capital goods or up here producing consumer goods. So the labor force then begins to increase. Now, where do these labors come from? Even though consumers have not decreased their demand for consumer goods, suddenly labor is being shifted out, pulled down, shifting from consumer to capital goods industries. Okay, they're going to be pulled down to here. So you're going to get an increase in the labor force in capital goods industries, and you're going to get an increase in the supply of capital goods. So for a while, there's going to be more capital goods. What's going to happen up here? Against the wishes of consumers, they're going to get more capital goods, which they don't want. They haven't saved more or invested more. And on the other hand, they're going to get fewer consumer goods for a while, okay? which they haven't. They haven't expressed a lower demand for consumer goods. So that's when you get the inflationary boom. Once the workers here get paid the new money, okay, once these workers that have shifted out of the consumer goods industry, once they get paid the new money for building these capital goods, they haven't changed their time preference. They now have more income. So they're going to use most of that new money to spend on consumer goods. So what's going to happen is that the prices of consumer goods are going to go up again. The demand for consumer goods is going to go up. The price of consumer goods are going to go up, profits and so on, and then the wages are going to go up, and labor is going to be pulled back this way. Now, why doesn't that happen every time the Fed increases? And so we're going to have a recession almost immediately. Okay, if nothing else happened, we'd have a small recession almost immediately. The laborers would be drawn back into the consumer goods industries. Some of the capital goods industries would, or capital goods firms, will go out of business, or they'll suffer losses. But it would happen very quickly, and it wouldn't be a very big deal. So what stops that from happening? Well, the fact that the Fed keeps increasing the money supply, keeps increasing bank reserves. They don't want to get the signs of recession. They keep injecting reserves into the banking system. They're focused on the interest rate to keep the interest rate down so that this process can go on for a while, go on for years. So you can postpone. So the inflationary boom is going to go on. The money supply is going to continue to rise. Wages will rise, first in capital goods industries. But then when the money gets paid out to the workers, then they begin to spend out more consumer goods, and prices and profits and wages of consumer goods industries go up. The only way to keep the boom going is to keep the capital goods industries one step ahead of the consumer goods industries. That is, you keep giving them the new money through the financial system, keeping the prices low. So they're one step ahead. The prices and profits go up faster in the capital goods industries than in the consumer goods industries. And that keeps labor working to produce these malinvestments, these capital goods which should never be produced. Okay. So let's say then the Fed gets scared. and it gets scared when we begin to have a high inflation. So, and that began to occur, for example, in 1980. Inflation had shot up to about 10% more, actually had gone up to 16%. So at that point, the Fed stepped on the brake, and we had the very deep double-dip recession of 1980-1982. Same thing happened in 1990, and the Fed stepped on the brake again. Okay, it didn't cause deflation, but it reduced the rate of growth of the money supply. The interest rates jumped up. Same thing happened in 2006. 2006, when Greenspan slowed the rate of increase of money supply, and interest rates went from 1% all the way up to 6%. That again caused problems, because when the interest rate goes up, you begin to get fewer companies borrowing. They realize that they can't afford to continue to build these capital goods. The interest rate on the loans is higher now. Also, they can't compete with the consumer goods industries, which are getting now this new money as they pay it out and are pushing up wages. In consumer goods industries, so you begin to get what the Austrians call the recession readjustment. The interest rate jumps back up, loans go down, and once the loans go down, you get a fall in investment spending and demand for capital goods, prices of capital goods, the wages in the capital goods industries, and the labor force. As they begin to lose money because of the lower prices and as these profits turn to losses, they begin to lay off workers, okay? And when the workers are laid off, they can't find jobs immediately in the consumer goods industry. So we have unemployment for a while as the workers are readjusted or are reabsorbed back into the correct structure of production. This one has been distorted. So they have to. So it takes a while for entrepreneurs. First of all, entrepreneurs lose their confidence. It's true, the Keynesians say that during a recession, entrepreneurs become pessimistic. But the point is, it's not their pessimism that causes the recession. It's the recession that causes their pessimism. They sit back and they wonder, what did I do wrong? I've made money for all these years, and now in 2007, I'm sitting here and everything is falling down around my ears. So I don't know what to do. So they hold back on reinvesting. So you get the more uncertainty there is among laborers, rather among entrepreneurs, the more time it takes for laborers to be reabsorbed back into the consumer goods industries. So what you get then is the temporary unemployment in the capital goods industries, and if the government steps in and tries to keep wages up as they did in the 1930s, or if they try to keep asset prices up as they have in the last 5-6 years, then you're going to get a prolonged stagnation, a prolonged depression. Labor shifts back eventually to consumer goods industries. You get more consumer goods and fewer capital goods produced. And some of the capital goods, some of the oil wells that have been sunk or the mines that have been opened, they have to be abandoned because there's not enough laborers to man them. The laborers are shifted back to consumer goods industries. The wages are too high now. They find they can't, with the lower amount of with the higher interest rate and the fewer loans they're taking out, they can't pay all the wages that they were paying before. So they have to let workers go. So some of the capital goods have been abandoned. Others are used in lower value uses than they would have been used. So we get a destruction of part of the capital stock. And so that means that we become poorer during the recession. Also, and this especially happened during the financial crisis, when the government drives asset prices up, like it did with housing and like it did with stock prices, from 2001 through 2005 and 6, what happens is that households, which own the houses, and so their equity is going up tremendously, and they own financial assets in their 401k and pension plans, they suddenly realize that, you know what, I can my savings for the future is going way up, so I can cut back on what I'm saving today because my 401k is going up, the value of my house is going up. In fact, I can actually dissave. I can actually use my my house or the equity in my house as an ATM. That is, I can just cash out and begin spending on consumer goods. So you get a consumption boom. Okay, so that happens. Now the consumption boom pulls some of the resources out of production of capital and brings it into the production of consumer goods, which people would not have purchased if it wasn't for this boom in asset prices. So you get two ways in which capital is destroyed. One, you get the malinvestment. The wrong things are being invested in. And two, you get overconsumption. So of the saving, the actual saving that's actually left, the real saving, some of that saving is pulled out and spent on capital goods. People thinking that they're wealthier than they really are. And then later on, when the housing prices fall, and their 401ks collapse, as they did in 2007, 2008, they realize they consume too much. So it's not just business decision makers, entrepreneurs that are fooled by the Fed, but also consumers. So you get the readjustment. Now let me go back to another diagram to show you this graphically. How the readjustment occurs. I showed you this last week, but now we're going to bring the Fed in. So this, the demand and supply on this diagram shows demand and supply for savings. And let's say it's $200 billion. That's how much people are voluntarily saving, how much households are voluntarily saving out of their incomes, and how much is then being borrowed on, this is the loan market, borrowed on the loan market by businesses, okay, at 5%. So 5%, all the voluntary saving is being borrowed by businesses, and the businesses can find all the funds they want at 5%. Now, if the Fed increases the money supply by, let's say, $100 billion through the banking system, so they increase reserves, banking reserves, more money loaned out, let's say $100 billion more is loaned out, what happens is that then it appears as if savings has increased, okay? So you have a surplus of savings. In order to loan that out, the bank has to lower the interest rate, as I mentioned. So let's say it falls to 3%. At 3%, many more investment projects look profitable than do at 5%. So more money borrowed, more investments are made. You begin to get what's called malinvestment. Now, as long as the Fed keeps increasing the money supply, okay, and keeping that interest rate down at 3%, it's going to be able to continue the boom. The boom's going to continue. Okay, but once the Fed stops, increasing the money supply, remember that money is paid out in wages, and then when those wages are spent by the workers, they're spent on mainly on consumer goods. And so what happens is that they're not put back into voluntary savings. So this arrow going back shows that when the Fed stops increasing the money supply, and the money runs through the system and is paid out to the workers who are drawn into the construction goods industry, the supply of savings shifts back this way to the old level. And now you have only 5%, and now your interest rate rises to 5%. And instead of $300 billion in savings, okay, which is false, it's really $200 billion plus $1 billion or $100 billion of created credit that the Fed has created out of thin air, you really, it goes back to showing the reality. The reality is there's only enough savings in the economy for an interest rate of 5%. Okay? So now there's access to much less saving by the entrepreneurs, and so they have to cut back. So that's showing this graphically. That is, they have to reduce the amount they're investing. And as a result, part of that is invested in wages. So and part of it's invested in capital goods that are being built. So now you get unemployment in the capital goods industries, and you get unused capital goods and so on, all the signs of a recession. So that's showing it in the form of a supply and demand graph. Okay, so now there's some criticisms of the Austrian theory. One is, why doesn't the recession occur immediately after the Fed inflates the money supply? Inflation can go on for years and years. Okay, as it did during the 1970s, as it did during the 1980s, we had inflation. Okay, inflation of the money supply certainly, and as we had inflation of the money supply during the from 2001 to 2006. Well, I've already explained that. Okay, really, we don't have to explain that again. That's part of the Austrian theory. The reason why is because as long as the Fed targets interest rates and keeps them low by printing more money, it can keep this boom going. Okay, eventually, people will start to anticipate the fact that prices are going up, and then they'll begin to spend their money faster. The demand for money will fall. At that point, inflation will get out of control. Not only will there be prices going up because of an increase in the money supply, but people will want to demand less money, want to hold less money, and they'll start spending that faster. So even if the money supply is going up by 7 or 8%, price may start to go up by 12, 14, 16%. And that's what happened at the end of the 1970s. Okay? The money supply may have been increasing at 8 or 10%, but prices are increasing by much more, 16%, so on. So eventually the Fed, in other words, if it wants to avoid hyperinflation, it has to slam on the brakes, cause the interest rate to rise, and then cause recession adjustment. That is, bring labor and other resources, shift them back out of capital goods, which people have not saved more for and do not demand, back to the consumer goods industries. Okay, two, how come businessmen do not learn their lesson and refrain from borrowing and investing when the Fed inflates the money supply and drives interest rates down to artificially low levels? Well, there's a number of reasons for this. Number one, even if they did learn their lesson, well, then that recession doesn't happen. I mean, they can learn the lesson, okay? They may not take that money and invest in expanding their operations and buying new capital goods. They may just take it and bid up the wages of labor. So, but the goal of the recessions we don't see, okay? When there is a recession, it means that they have not learned their lesson. And why might they not learn their lesson? One reason is ideology. For example, Greenspan convinced everybody in the 1990s and well into the next decade, the first decade of the 21st century, he convinced everybody that the Fed could control interest rates. The Fed could set interest rates and keep them at low levels forever or indefinitely, pretty much. And so businesses bought into that. Greenspan was known as the maestro, right? The media bought into it. The media spread that message that from now on we'll have low interest rates and the Fed to control these low interest rates and prevent inflation and so on. All right, so that's one of the reasons. Okay, they have learned the lesson, but then they're talked out of it by the Federal Reserve and by the media that is subservient to the Federal Reserve in many cases. And also, even if you know the Austrian theory and you've learned your lesson, you would still, it might pay you as it goes on, you'll see that, look, I'm losing market share. I'm not expanding. My other firms are taking this cheap money, they're expanding, they're undercutting me, I'm losing money, or I'm not earning as much as I used to be earning, so therefore I'm going to take some of this cheap credit, begin to expand, and then I'll sell my operations, or I'll try to get out right before the bust. But if I go on like I am, where other businesses are expanding, and I'm getting pushed out of the market, well, you know, I don't want to do that. Okay, so even if you've learned your lesson, okay, there is an incentive to continue to partake in this inflationary boom. And also, learning your lesson is very difficult because most people are not familiar with the Austrian business cycle theory. They just look at, they believe what they read in the media, the financial press, or what they hear from the Fed. Okay, and the Fed message is that it's never responsible for any of this stuff. That there aren't any really real business cycles, it's just fluctuations. So, you know, if households spend too little or investors have animal spirits, then that might cause a fluctuation, but we can't predict that. So there's no lesson to be learned. In fact, Greenspan said, there is no bubble. Even if there was a bubble, we couldn't do anything about it, we wouldn't know it. And even if we did know that there was a bubble, there's nothing we can do about it. So he was setting people up to see that, what, you know, or to believe that there's really nothing that we can do, even if there are some fluctuations, there's nothing that we can do about it. The third criticism is, why does the shift of labor from consumer goods to capital goods industries during the boom occur without higher unemployment? Okay, so in other words, there is no unemployment during the boom, right, when labor shifting, but the shift back during the recession causes high unemployment. Well, because in one case, in the case of the boom, people are reacting to monetary calculation. They see the interest rate going down, they expand their businesses, they bid already employed workers away from from consumer goods industries into capital goods industries. But during recession, monetary calculation is broken down. People realize they've made mistakes. So the entrepreneurs don't trust, they don't trust themselves. They don't trust themselves to make the economic calculations, the calculations of profits and loss and of wealth that they made before. In other words, they begin to lose faith in their own ability and in the ability of the price system to tell them the truth. But the point is that it was the Fed intervention into the price system, distorting capital goods prices and consumer goods prices and interest rates, that caused them to make these mistakes. So they have to sort of relearn faith in themselves, which they do over time, and they have to see that the price system is giving them the correct signals or information. And why do we have prolonged mass unemployment during the Great Depression? Well, very briefly, the government intervened to try to stop wages from falling, prices from falling, to try to keep interest rates low. In other words, they basically just kept adding to the problems by not allowing the economy to adjust, to readjust, as Austrians would say. That is, not allow labor to shift back at lower wages back to the capital goods industry. Okay, so real quick, what are the do's and don'ts of depressions for Austrians? First is that the recession is a readjustment process. It's the inflationary boom that distorts the structure of production. It's the recession that puts it back in its right order. Okay? And that takes longer. It's easier to destroy something, to smash something, than it is to put things back. And that's why you have the unemployment for a long period of time. Production must be readjusted to the true time preferences of consumers. That is, interest rates have to go back up. You have to get fewer consumer goods and more capital goods being produced. Therefore, there has to be a reduction in prices and production of capital goods. The price of capital goods, the price of steel, cement, and so on, they have to fall. On the other hand, they have to fall relative to consumer goods. So you usually see construction companies going out of business or steel companies going out of business during a recession. You don't see Sears going out of business during a recession, or Walmart, or restaurant. Though some restaurants go out of business, or big chains, McDonald's going out of business. The reason is because there isn't an overproduction of consumer goods. There's an overproduction of capital goods, and so you have to move back to producing more consumer goods. So it does mean that some capital goods firms must go bankrupt, and that there must be unemployment in these firms. Okay, until workers find their correct and most valuable uses in the consumer goods industries. So and the don'ts are: don't interfere with the recession, allow the price adjustment to take place, allow interest rates to rise to their natural levels. Don't reinflate the money supply, allow the prices and wages to fall to levels that clear the markets. Okay, you want prices to fall, especially if the money supply collapses. Or especially people don't want to spend money because they're fearful for their jobs, or because they're going to take wage cuts. They're going to hold on to more money. Even if the money supply hasn't fallen, that's going to put a down pressure on prices as people cut back on their spending. The demand for money increases. Okay, there's one more or two more slides I want to show you very quickly, and I'll get to questions. It seems that this is not cooperating again. Yeah. I can't get the even going.
What's been happening is that eventually it finishes processing whatever it's having a hard time processing, and then it becomes movable. But until that point, it's just locked up.
Is it locked up now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll show that it's unlocked when all of your scrolls go through.
Okay, I'm just being instructed that this is locked up. So we can go on. Well, I do want to compare the Keynesian and Austrian solutions, but I'll take a question in the meantime. Someone asked, if the new money went directly to consumers via welfare, will it create a boom-bust cycle via rising consumer prices versus capital goods prices? That's a very, very good question, very astute question. And the answer is no, we'll not create a boom-bust cycle. The new money goes directly to consumers. Consumers will spend the money first. Consumer goods will, labor will shift to producing more consumers' goods, and we'll have fewer capital goods. It will not cause a boom bust cycle in the same way. Okay, and I think I mentioned this last time. If, for example, even if the government didn't create the new money, it just taxed people and pay welfare benefits. And the people who are on welfare tend to be bigger consumers. So some consumers, the bigger consumers, or they have higher time preferences than the people, the taxpayers. Yes, okay. I apologize for the interruption. We were disconnected from the internet unexpectedly. But we now have slides back. So just the other two don'ts were don't support wages and prices above equilibrium levels, and don't raise taxes. Okay, if you raise taxes, it reduces the amount that people will save. When you reduce people's income in the present, that means that they're gonna save less and consume more as a result of that. And also because when government spends, the spending itself is really consumption spending. So if the government takes $100 from you, and let's say you would have saved 30 of that and spent 70 on consumption, the government spends all 100 on consumption. So that means that the time preferences go up in the economy, and we actually have less saving. The more saving there is in the economy, the better off we are. All right, let me just. And finally, don't, as I said, don't raise government spending because it's basically consumption. Okay. And then the do's are: you want to cut taxes, because when you cut taxes, you reduce people's consumption saving ratio, right? If they have more money because they have more because now their incomes have gone up. The higher your income is in the present, the more you're willing to, or the greater proportion you're willing to devote to the future. And when you increase in saving, as a result of cutting taxes, that puts downward pressure on the interest rate in a good way. That's it causes the national interest rate to fall, and it causes some increase in investment. And so some of the capital goods that were produced wrongly during the boom can be saved and used. Okay, so unemployment will fall. Okay, you also want to cut government spending for the same reason. If you cut government spending, you cut the deficit. What that does is that also lowers the interest rate. Okay, and raises investment and lowers unemployment. You want to freeze the money supply. You want to prevent the Fed from continuing to buy any assets on the open market. You want to stop open market operations so that the money is not created and flowing through financial markets, which distorts interest rates. Okay? You want to repeal all laws that cause prices and wages to be rigid, including the minimum wage and special privileges for unions, which came about with the National Labor Relations Act of mid-1930s. Okay. And that will make the job market more open and less rigid, and it will cure unemployment more quickly during a recession. And so you want to repeal business regulations, which raise the cost of production. So if you lower that, that will increase profits, it will increase the natural interest rate, that is, there'll be a bigger spread between what they sell for, what they and the cost of producing things, and so you get an increase in the amount of the supply of goods. Okay. Now finally, what about the Austrians versus the Keynesians? I'll get back to the questions after this. So the Austrians' fiscal policy is you cut taxes, you cut government spending, you cut the deficit, T minus G, that's the government deficit, taxes minus government spending. And if you do that, now Krugman would call some of that austerity, but notice it's not austerity for consumers, because consumers or households, private individuals and firms, they have a cut in taxes. They have more income left themselves. It's only austerity for the government, okay? And you want the government to spend less. The Keynesians will cut taxes too, so they agree with the Austrians there, but it doesn't seem that Obama does. He wants to raise taxes. If you saw last night's address, State of the Union address, he wants to raise taxes. But even Keynesians usually are against raising taxes during a recession. They're also in favor of more government spending, and they're in favor of budget deficit, that is, T minus G being less than zero, whereas Austrians want to balance the budget or even have just lower spending in general. Monetary policy, you want Austrians want no change in the money supply, whereas Keynesians want money supply to be increased and interest rates to be pushed down. They can't push them down anymore nowadays because they think that will spur investment spending and get us out of the recession. On microeconomic policy, Austrians want to repeal the laws keeping the wages and prices above equilibrium. Okay, that will hasten the cure of unemployment. Whereas the Keynesians are in favor of government laws, minimum wage laws, unions keeping wages above equilibrium levels, and so on. Finally, regulations. Austrians want a wholesale abolition of regulations on business. Whereas, for example, Keynesians, with the latest financial crisis, they want to increase regulations on especially the financial sector, which was part of the problem to begin with. So the summary is, and I get the questions after this, Austrians want to save our way out of the depression. We want, the more money you save, the more capital goods can be utilized. Okay? The fewer resources you have to move back to capital, back from the capital goods to the consumer goods. Okay? Whereas the Keynesians want to spend their way out of depression. Okay, that just makes things worse. Okay, so now let me take some of the questions. It says, one question is, why do interest rates go down when the banks are inflating? Why not credit standards instead? Both go down, okay? So interest rates do go down when banks are inflating, but they'll also lower the credit standards. And since part of the interest rate, or part of the rate that we see, is really the risk component, what's going to happen is that when you lower credit standards but don't change the interest rate, what you're doing is you're giving less creditworthy people access to those funds. Okay, so more people are going to get the funds in general. Okay, so if you get extra created funds, you may not lower the interest rates. You may lower a little bit, but you may give more and more people who want credit after pay 5%. They wouldn't get it before at 5. They would have gotten it at 7 or 8. You'll give them those funds at 5%. Okay, and that's what happened to a great extent with the housing boom. Okay, it wasn't just lowering the mortgage rate, but it was also all the departures from sound lending policies that took place. The liar loans, the no documentation loans, and so on. Someone asked, can you explain forced savings again? Yeah, very briefly. Forced savings occurs when money is given to one group. Let's say new money is created, and it's given to, let's say, the businesses that borrow it at low interest rates. When they begin to spend that money on labor and on to invest, when they invest it in producing more capital goods, that's of that is bidding labor away from consumer goods industries. So for a while, you're going to get fewer consumer goods. So in effect, even though people don't want fewer consumer goods and more capital goods, they are forced, that's the force, they're forced to save. Okay, they're forced to save in the sense that they are now provided with fewer consumer goods and more capital goods. There's been a shift to capital goods despite the fact that their time preferences haven't changed, that they do not desire more savings. So it's forced in that sense. In order to freeze the money supply, another questioner says, you said open market operations must cease, but wouldn't the Fed have to continue open market operations to some extent as government securities on their balance sheet are paid off? Yeah, the Fed pays back the some of the government securities. They would that would deflate the money supply. So as they pay back as the revenue goes back to the government. But that can be offset. I mean, I think paying back to the Treasury is a little bit different than actually open market operations. Okay, so paying that money back to the Treasury is not the same thing as buying more bonds. Then someone asks, it seems in a fractional reserve system there is no clear distinction between one's cash balances and savings in the Austrian sense, since money held in checking and savings accounts are then lent out at interest. Do you agree? Yeah, to an extent, what are called savings accounts, you're right, are not really savings accounts. They're demand deposits. Even though you can't write checks on some of them, you can certainly, as I said, get them out of ATMs. You can withdraw them immediately. You can have them shifted into your checking accounts by phone, through your ATM, and so on. However, there is still real savings, and the real savings are if you put your money in mutual funds, you put your money in money market mutual funds or mutual bond mutual funds. If you buy stock and so on, and you can go through the banks. When you go through the banks, you truly save, you put your money in certificates of deposit that do not mature for a period of time, 3 months, 6 months, 2 years. Okay, there's another. Okay, here's the question. In 2008, all kinds of consumer companies went out of business. Best Buy, Sharper Image. During the boom, there was no price hikes in consumer goods. What gives? And that's a very good question. I wrote a paper on this in which I showed that there was an overconsumption boom. So we had a lot of overconsumption, and we had a lot of iconic companies going out of business, as this person points out. Best Buy, Sharper Image, Fortune Offs, a number of furniture companies. But you still had more. You still had much more distress, let's say, in capital goods industries. Though we did have a lot of distress in consumer goods industries because people found out that they were much poorer than they thought they were, and they began to cut back radically on their spending as they found that their 401ks now became 201ks. So they're cut in half. And the equity in their house, some 20, 40, 50% of the equity just disappeared. So they began to increase their rate of saving. The personal rate of saving had fallen to 1% at the top of the boom. So it shot back up to 5 and 6% later on. That's just personal saving in the economy. That doesn't include this, saving by business, which reinvests its earnings. That's also part of the same retained earnings. It was a little bit different because of the asset bubble. We never had an asset bubble quite that big, and we never had an overconsumption mania like we did during that period. It happened somewhat in the 1990s, but you didn't get the mass bankruptcy among any of the consumer goods firms. How does the Austrian business cycle theory differ from the real business cycle theory? Well, as the name indicates, real business cycle theory, the proponents of the real business cycle theory do not believe that money supply really has much to do with causing a business cycle. They believe that real forces do. For example, unanticipated technological changes can cause business cycles. Technological changes that go backwards, they never really explain what that is, the proponents of the system, but they that's one of the causes. Okay, these technological shocks that come into the economy. Another question asks: is liquidity preference, the cash balance people prefer to hold, distinct from time preference, present consumption versus future consumption? There is some argument among Austrians on this, but I think most would agree that liquidity preference, the desire to hold cash, is different from time preference, because cash is neither a consumer's good or a producer's good. Cash is a present good, despite the fact that you're not spending it. It's a present good in the sense that it's giving you security against future uncertainty. It's giving you security in the case of future emergencies, or it's giving you the wherewithal to spend on when you see a sale or a great deal, you have that money on hand. It's the same thing as, for example, you might say that a fire extinguisher, which is never used, just hangs on your wall, is not a present good. But it is a present good, okay? It gives you security. So that's, the money is not that, or even a piece of art that just hangs on your wall, okay? You're getting continual consumption benefits from the services of viewing that beautiful piece of art, for example. So things like fire extinguishers are like money in that it doesn't appear as if they're present good, but in fact they are present good. There was something else. Oh yeah. So present consumption versus future consumption is different from that. Okay. So future consumption, if you put your money into a 10-year zero coupon bond, so that in 10 years you're going to get the full amount of the bond back plus interest for your child's tuition, that in fact is future consumption when you buy that bond. Okay, it's not a cash balance. Okay, so holding cash does give you present benefits. I'm looking for other questions here.
No more questions.
No, I don't have any more questions.
One thing you had mentioned, that you were talking about sort of don't-do-lists.
Yeah.
And John Cochrane's don't-do-lists article talking about Rothbard's don't-do-list and the Great Depression about recession.
Right.
And he posted it early next week.
Okay. I'm just informed that regarding my don't-do-list, Murray Rothbard also has a don't-do-list that could be gleaned from his America's Great Depression, and John Cochran, who is one of our senior scholars, has an article that will be coming out next week. You can look at it on Rothbard's Don't Do List, what you're not supposed to do during recession, during depressions. And John's a very good Austrian, so I'm looking forward to reading it, and as you should be. I was cut off on one of the questions, I think, when we disconnected. I could go back to that. Someone had asked about, I think I probably only answered about half of it before we got disconnected. Let's see. Yeah, someone said if the new money went directly to consumers via welfare, will it create a boom bust cycle via rising prices versus capital goods prices? And there, not necessarily in the same sense, okay? There will be a boom in consumers' goods as long as that money continues to be directed at people who are being subsidized. And as long as they're spending out of consumers' goods. So you will get an increase in consumption at the expense of production. But even if you sort of stopped inflation and only finance welfare out of taxes, you would still get that sort of continuing expansion or artificial growth of that consumer's goods industries. Okay, so it would come to an end when the government stops subsidizing, whether it's via taxes, whether it's spending money via taxes or inflation. When it stops subsidizing that group of people on welfare, okay, then those firms that were catering to the demand of those people would suddenly not have that demand if the subsidy was taken away. Okay. And I mentioned, again, I think this is during the point when we're disconnected, if the government subsidizes apples, for apple production, for example, or let's say subsidizes consumers to buy apples for their health, well, then you get more apples purchased, and you get an expansion in apple orchards, and you get more workers there. But if the government stopped that program a few years later, regardless of how it was financed, and it was unanticipated that they were going to stop it, then you'll find that a lot of those apple orchards would go bankrupt, and you get a decrease in apples and production of more oranges or something like that, some other good. Okay. So someone asked, in teaching macro, intro macro, what would be the best text out there? I use McConnell and Brew. Okay, so McConnell and Brew. It's a little bit too mainstream for me. I'm teaching the principles of macro now this semester, and I'm using a book, which is good because it's short, and the economist isn't super Keynesian. It's by Gregory Mankiw, and it's called Principles of Macroeconomics. And I recommend that book because, unlike most macroeconomics texts, he doesn't start with unemployment and what causes unemployment. He doesn't start with macroeconomics even. He starts with micro, and then he goes to how markets adjust through price adjustments. And it's only the last two chapters of the book. Now, there's other things that authors would disagree with in the book. But it's only the last two chapters that he brings in Keynesian economics. And he says this is a special case where prices get stuck in the long run. So, I'm sorry, where prices get stuck in the short run. So what he does, he separates the economics of the long run, which is Austrian economics, or very close to Austrian economics, and he separates that out and shows how the price system works correctly and how the interest rate equilibrates saving and investing and so on, and how there's a natural economic growth, although his growth theory isn't the same as Austrian, he doesn't use the structure of production. But then in the last two chapters, he talks about the economics of the short run, and there prices don't adjust. They don't adjust right away, and that causes unemployment. But he devotes very little time to that compared to the to economics that most of that Austrians would agree with a lot of. Okay, not everything that he writes. Okay, someone asked a question about Rothbard on page 39 of his Economic Depressions. That is his pamphlet. It says, what the economy needs is not more consumption spending, but more saving in order to validate some of the excessive investments of the boom. And this person wants to know, does he mean the savings can go to complete abandoned projects? Okay, that's a very, very good question. I touched on it somewhat in my lecture tonight. Basically what it means, and we'll end here, is that when you save more during a recession, you'll have more voluntary saving. So though the Fed has stopped increasing the money supply, let's say, you will get an increase in the amount of saving in the economy, which will push the supply of funds out to the right. And that will lower the interest rate naturally. So you will, because of that natural lowering of the interest rate, some of these capital goods that have been produced will be either completed or you'll have workers coming in and they may be completed already. The workers may now be bid away from the consumer goods industry, and they'll begin to operate these underutilized capital goods. Okay, so theoretically, if people suddenly start to save like crazy during a recession, you could actually avoid the recession altogether. That is, as the government stopped increasing the money supply, if people began saving, the government cut taxes tremendously. people began saving a lot, then the interest rate might not jump up again. Okay, it might stay at 3%. That's very unlikely. Okay, but any bit of saving, a voluntary saving, does mitigate or lessen the effects of the recession. It means that you have to make less of an adjustment. You can keep more workers in the capital goods industries, and you don't have to lay them off. So I'll stop here. Thank you very much for taking the course. I enjoyed teaching it, and I like answering your questions. So have a good night.
Thank you, Dr. Slaner.